This special NABFX podcast is made possible in part by the support of DaVinci. Learn what the top post-production facilities around the world already know. DaVinci Systems offers the industry's finest image enhancement products. Visit DaVinci at www.davsys.com. By GenArts, creators of the Sapphire plugins, the essential VFX toolkit for digital artists. Swing by booth SL2829 for a demo of Sapphire on Autodesk Systems, Avid, and After Effects, or visit www.genarts.com for more information. This podcast is also made possible in part by SohoNet. SohoNet is the largest high-bandwidth connector for the global entertainment industry, delivering secure, high-speed connectivity to major media companies across Europe, the U.S., and Australasia. SohoNet also provides complete technology consulting on all digital workflow issues.
Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hey, and welcome to today's FX Podcast from NAB. Man, day one is over. What a day. We're going to go through that. We've got a room full of guests today. Why don't we go around and introduce everyone, starting here on my right.
Are we giving like long, full introductions?
Oh, yeah.
My name is Emery. My name is Emery Wells, and I'm from New York. I'm a producer in New York, visual effects, stuff like that, fun stuff.
Great.
Hey, everybody. Scott Brook, also from New York, producer, and it was an exciting day. And I got to say, it's a real privilege to be on this show. I'm a huge, huge fan.
Hey, thanks. We're really happy to have you. And, of course, you know my voice, Mike, and I'm joined with, as always, by...
Jeff Huser. Hello, everyone.
God, I wish I had your voice, man. You're Montgomery.
Come on, I want unlike the charm voice.
Well, okay, but still, I'm the 14-year-old boy with the men.
So we're here relaxing in the suite back at Caesars, and the day started off pretty early for us, heading over to NAB. And we ran into these guys at the Red Booth, which is where we started our day.
And you know what? I just gotta say hats off, because you got into the first showing of the Peter Jackson film.
Well, you know, we didn't get in so officially to the first screening. You know, we came early to register or to pick up our badges. We already registered, and once we got our badges, we realized that we were in the hall. It was like 8 a.m., and we're like, oh well. Shit, we're in the hall. Let's stay here. So we walked over to the Red Booth and we waited around for like 45 minutes. So yeah, we got to see the first screening.
Conspicuously hiding from security and trying to stay
really tough.
So we're like there, going, we're going to get in. You know, the door's only just open. We're here for okay, bastards.
That was a hand fist.
Yeah, damn you.
Did you guys run over from the main entrance?
We didn't run like girls, but we did walk with a brisk fashion, kind of to get there. But well, you know what the heck. Hey, we went there for a reason, though, because Red is a significantly interesting product, and it's interesting to the post community as it is to the production community for a whole bunch of reasons. But I guess we should go around the table and find out. Did everybody get to the Red Booth today?
I got to the booth. I didn't get to the film yet.
Because there was a queue.
I had to come late this morning.
Yeah, the line was about, insane. I mean, from what I heard, the line was about an hour or an hour and a half to get in to see the film.
So in other words, you got into a premiere of a Peter Jackson film before the rest of the world, and surprise, surprise, there was a queue after you.
I was completely unaware that it was going to be a short film. I thought it was just going to be test footage that they had shot. So when they sat down and they started the thing, it just absolutely blew me away. And you know, I'm sure we'll talk about more, but just the ability of like, one, the pacing of the thing and the excitement of it and the fact that it was Red, and just also just the beauty of it, just the true latitude you got to see of the camera. Just really seeing it puts it, you know, through its paces, just it's really a remarkable experience.
Yeah, hats off to them actually from a standpoint of doing something like that, because presenting something in that form really, I think, actually helped sell it and really helped point out how strong and how far they've come in a year.
So the whole thing, before we move off the filmmaking aspect of the Red camera, I mean, the bottom line is there's a lot of issues over making a film like that, right? There's like the production process, there's how you deal with the data flow. There's a whole lot of issues to make a film like that work, which makes me think it'd be a good idea to actually make a film.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, Mike, because in fact, that's what we're going to do. And I guess we have sort of an announcement to make. We're collaborating, Scott and me from New York and the FX Guide crew and FX PhD guys, which is you guys. To do a new website focused on the Red camera, specifically about the workflow issues you mentioned. It's going to be projectred.net. And this is really sort of, we hope, you know, going to be a really fun project. We're going to run the camera through a real production scenario. It's going to be open source, which I think that's kind of one of the key points of this thing, is that we're going to do an open source project. Our project files, our source plates, they're all going to be available for you guys to download and play with. And we also, we know who we are, but we're also going to bring in a lot of other really great people from all over the world to work on this project. We know that you guys are interested in all sorts of things, you know. Directors are interested in things that are relevant to directing, and the same for producers and post-production and visual effects. So everyone that's going to work on the project, we're all going to have our own blogs, and we're going to be documenting the process and giving you information that's relevant to your part of the workflow. So we're excited.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea here is to be community-based. And, I mean, FX Guide started with that. We started way back in the day. What was that, 97, 99, some darn thing in the 90s. Was that right? Whatever, and the whole point of starting, right, was for us to share with the community. And so, of course, it was a natural fit when we bumped into these guys and started talking about this, because the idea for us, anyway, is to be really open and inclusive, because it's not about, like, you know, somebody trumping somebody else with doing something better or whatever. It's about opening up for the community to the new workflow so we can all learn, all benefit. So this is like a non-profit, you know, it's just like a thing that we're all doing collaboratively and with a bunch of people. And already, just today, we've had some really great responses from people we've been talking to. So that server, that website, do you want to give the URL again? And also, I think it should be up right as you're hearing this, but for any reason it isn't, it'll be up in the, because we literally threw the switch tonight. Large popping of champagne and much to do.
there we go. So yeah, the URL is going to be projectred.net, and if you guys go there and it's not working, it should be up shortly. The DNS is updating, yeah.
Get through the net.
And there's a link there, and you can leave your name and your email address so that we can contact you if you want to be in the loop of what's going on. And over time, and as this project evolves, we'll be shooting on multiple different continents. So if we're shooting in a city or country where you're at, hopefully you can come along. You can share in that experience. It's all, however, going to be like a very professional exercise, isn't it? I mean, we're not talking here about like amateur hour at the home movies thing. We're going to try proper production with a full professional crew and DOPs, etc.
As close to a real production scenario as possible is really the main goal.
I think that's the most important thing. It's that, you know, look, I mean, we all share a high degree of enthusiasm for the camera, the ethic of the camera, and just, you know, the community-based aspect, Mike, that you're referring to. I think it's really important to us. And I don't want to be cheesy about it, but the fact that we're all, between the three of us, like very high reservation number holders, we're going to have these cameras within probably the next month and a half. I just think it's important, and I think it's a lot of fun to share back with other people that are waiting or on the fence about how this is going to impact their own, you know, potential productions. And I think that we'll develop best practices and hopefully hear from a lot of people about things that they'd like to see us do with the cameras, and also, you know, just running it through its paces. It's going to be a valuable participation-based experience.
I think it's going to be really interesting because it's not going to be perfect, too. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's going to be a new procedure. We'll have best practice. We'll have a list of worst practices probably by the time it's done.
Don't do this with a red camera.
Yeah,
that's right. And anybody that accuses us of being red fanboys, we're not going to just tell you the positive aspects of red, but, you know, also the negative aspects or what you don't want to do, like you're saying, John. So we're going to cover the complete gamut of the camera, working with it. What's it really like to run it through a production process?
And we've been speaking to the guys at Red, and they've been incredibly supportive, haven't they? I mean, we've spoken to them on the booth, and we're talking to them again tomorrow. And so hopefully you can be involved in this and interested in what's going on with it.
Yeah, and I think what's also cool is that this is a very, you know, this is a unique type of experience. It's not just another, hey, this is information about the Red, it's a blog, it's, you know, it's fan-based. This is something I think that's going to kind of live side by side with a bunch of the other sites, and hopefully we can all complement each other and, you know, contribute to the bigger experience with these cameras, which I really do think it's going to be, like, you know, it's going to be a revolutionary experience, and it's a good way to share it.
So we should get into some of those workflow issues, because there are some pretty interesting things beneath the hood of the camera that we discovered today. I certainly was really interested in one aspect, because I was talking to the guys at Pixel Farm to do PF Track, because as many of you know, I'm really interested in 3D tracking. And one of the interesting technologies that at the moment has come from Cook has the idea of encoding in the lens itself data information that can be straight into either a USB if you're on a film camera or into the data stream of, say, a digital camera. And this data stream will tell you about what's going on with the lens at any particular point in time on a per-frame basis. Now, you might think, well, that's a good thing because you kind of know what's going on with the zoom, for example, but it goes far deeper than that. And a good example that the PF track uses is, and by the way, we should say that the PF Track guys are incredibly enthusiastic about working us with FX PhD next term, or the term after next. We're just starting a new term now. But when you take in this data to, say, PF Track, if you have, for example, a wide-angle lens, it's going to be lens distortion. And as we know, that's a really critical point in solving 3D tracking. But here's what's going to happen is that it's going to look up the serial number from that data stream of that individual lens. It then accesses a database that tells you all of the optical aberrations and lens distortions for that lens at every f-stop. And so as you'll know the f-stop from the lens as well, that totally feeds the 3D solution, and so you get a much, much better 3D track. And of course, we're really glad today to hear that this is going to be in every red lens from day one. Now, it may not be enabled when the first lens is shipped, but if you later, you know, it gets enabled, then all the lenses that you've bought from day one will have it. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
They announced some lenses today too, didn't they?
Absolutely.
They announced a set of red primes, which is definitely not anything to gloss over. I mean, it's not everybody is going to, I don't think everyone's going to want to buy, you know, the set of red primes, you know, especially if you're working with certain DPs that have a favorite lens or type of lens they want to use. You can certainly rent them, but to have a set of prime lenses for the collection, I think, is $20,000.
Was it five lenses?
That's right.
Five prime lenses is really, really incredible. I mean, it's the PL mount, Cine quality lenses. Of course, we don't really know how they're going to stack up until we get our hands on them and do some tests.
And there was a new zoom lens, right?
Yeah, there was actually, apparently the 1885, which was previously listed on the site, I think for $9,500, is that about right?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, they've said that that's going to be delayed, but in its place, shortly after ship of the cameras, will be an 18-50. And it's also, that's a great range. I mean, it's a workhorse lens. But on top of it, the beauty was that the price of the lens is about $3,000 less than the 18-85. It's $6,500. And I mean, for the existing lens reservation holders, you'll have an option of taking the 18-50 early.
Now, who got to look at the stuff to do with the red code RAW? Do you want to get to see the red Cine stuff?
I think it's one of the most exciting things for me was seeing the workflow stuff with red Cine and also directly with Final Cut Pro. So, I mean, if anybody's been following the news with Final Cut Pro for yesterday's announcement, they're going to support in the new Final Cut Studio. Final Cut Pro will support red code RAW natively in Final Cut. So you can bring in your red code RAW files directly into Final Cut Pro, and on the fly, it'll do demosaicing from the Bayer pattern data to an RGB image. Either there's like different choices. You can do like a 1K or a 2K image. You know, it'll depend on how much what your processing power is for the computer you're using. But for doing a DI finish in 4K, you can stay in the red code RAW that entire time if you want. Now you can also go into red Cine and of course transcode to any codec you have on your machine. But I think that's also, I mean, it's a really great, convenient workflow thing that you don't have to convert, you don't have to transcode to any other codec if you want to just get footage in and screw around with it real quick in Final Cut.
That's one of those things, again, I think they're doing really well. Okay, they're working on a codec that's QuickTime compatible, so you're automatically doing something that works in a lot of applications on the Mac, like Final Cut. So it's really smart that they're doing that. And it also helps, they were showing also at the Apple booth the idea of taking the red codec files and also turning them into the Pro Codec files with a new feature. So you can also take them into the new uncompressed format that they announced as well. So if you want to have a little faster playback, more layers, you can have that workflow as well in your setup. And again, I think that's a really good move to just make that happen with the new Final Cut.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, probably what a lot of people, I mean, certainly a lot of people have been following this camera for a while. And, you know, the technical pieces of the camera became more and more clear over time. But the big question for a lot of people is, how is this post-workflow going to work? And how intuitive is it? And just based on, they demonstrated the Red Cine application, which is incredibly intuitive. It is, it's one of those things that, I mean, just in the quick time they showed it, it's logical and it lets you quickly make adjustments, to white balance, to contrast, and the ability to get it out in the format that you want for post editing. Say, you want to dump it out to TIFF, or you want to dump it out to DPX, or you want to dump it out to QuickTime. It's a quick, easy process.
Now, did anyone work out the price on that? Because, I mean, people that are listening to this might be thinking, well, there's going to be a lot of red stuff generated, but I'm going to be at the post house dealing with it.
Did they say that it's going to be available for download? Is that
yeah, that's going to be available for download, effectively, and for lack of a better term, almost in continual beta. So there's not going to be necessarily great support for it, but if you're at a post-production facility where you have a client who brings in footage, you'll be able to access that download and have full access to it, which is, again, one of those really smart moves.
But also, the really cool thing is that it's not, I mean, you don't have to have the Red Cine software to work with it, especially for a broadcast delivery. If you have the new Final Cut Studio suite, you can work with those files natively, either in the native Red Code RAW, or, John, like you said, you can convert to the new ProRes 422 codec, which essentially gives you the same, you know, visual quality as lossless codec, but it's like, you know, it's the data rate's lower. I don't exactly know what the data. Did anybody catch the data rate
for the
ProRes?
For the ProRes, well, a terabyte of data at HD uncompressed would go down to 170 gigabytes of data, mm-hmm. and on the Red Code system, the Red Code RAW, I'm sorry, they're taking a single frame down from what is, I think, 20 is a single frame 24 RAW anyway, proper RAW. But the Red Code RAW will produce that 4K frame at 1 megabyte a frame. So we're talking about, you know, fairly large statistical, you know, 20-to-1 type compressions. And yet it should be ideal for keying and color correcting. Now, this is a really interesting aspect, and we have to just get those files to play with them to know about that. But I want to make one other point. You mentioned Final Cut. We're obviously going to come back and discuss that. And now the Red Cine stuff. But there's actually another company that's supporting the Red Code stuff, RAW, which is Assimilate with Scratch. And I mean, you ran into them, didn't you, Jeff?
Yeah, I ran into Lucas Wilson from Assimilate and talked to him briefly. Here we go.
What we've got new at the show is, well, natural evolution of our tools, fully mappable color panels, video I/O, scene detection, a whole bunch of new features. Probably one of the bigger things that we have going on is that we are one of the only companies around to natively support Red Code RAW out of the Red camera. So anything that's shot out of the Red camera, you can import directly into Scratch without having to go through Red Cine or any intermediary format. And also, if you take a look at the Red booth, we worked with Red and we were partners with them on Red Cine.
Yeah, you know, it's also, it should be noted that not only will it work in Scratch, but in theory, it should work in a lot of applications that support QuickTime. Now, again, in theory, it should work in all applications that support QuickTime, but the performance you're going to get will vary from application to application. Like, you know, Final Cut was optimized to do the demosaicing on the fly really, really quickly, but if you take it into another QuickTime capable application, it might not work as well.
The guys at the Red Booth were saying that even on a MacBook Pro, mm-hmm. that you can deal with about 1K, the real-time 1K proxy, and then working your way up on a faster system, of course, the 8-core system, you can do the 2K proxy.
Now, I can't give you a list, but I swear every demo I walked by today, somewhere at the end it was, oh, and we're going to support the Red Code RAW format.
Yeah.
Codec. So, I mean, I can't give you a list of that, but I swear I heard it a lot today.
I thought it was fascinating that Apple, I mean, that you can see the real, there's a real commitment by Apple to this project. I mean, if it was ever in doubt, the fact that you see in the demo, you know, in the new Final Cut videos that they're showing on the Apple site, I mean, it shows Red Code right on there. But they have a little breakout section within the Apple booth. There is a portion that says, you know, Final Cut, Red Code. You know, it's like, and they're demonstrating, like, actually, pieces of the Peter Jackson movie, like transcoding from the Red Code to the new codec,
and then that was all shot in Red Code RAW, the Jackson film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and getting back to that Assimilate thing, like the Assimilate Scratch thing is being picked up by quite a few places than doing, you know, stuff because it's a really good sort of 2 and obviously now I guess 4K assembly thing, and a lot of people are using assembly and playback and stuff, and so I've actually heard Assimilate mentioned a lot more at this NAB than.
All year long, actually. It's been kind of funny. I've not had experience with it. I've met the people. I know the guys. I've seen some demos. But I just keep hearing good things about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've used it a lot, obviously.
Oh, that's right.
And,
maybe that's where I heard it.
Yeah, maybe for me. But but I've been hearing it a lot more from other people. I'm friends at other facilities in LA and stuff that have been using it and stuff. So.
Same here.
Now, Mike, what about in the Final Cut Studio now you get color, which is, you know, taken from Final Touch, which Apple acquired this year. Would you still use Scratch over color? Do you have any experience with Final Touch?
Well, here's the thing, right? And this is really significant for those of you who haven't quite caught up in the news. There's this whole new module called Color added to the Final Cut bundle. Now, we'll come back and discuss some of the other stuff in Final Cut for a second. But this one app alone, you'd think they'd be charging hundreds of dollars for, is in fact effectively free because it's included at the previous price.
Well, how much?
One could argue thousands of dollars for it.
I was going to say they acquired this technology, and last year at NAB it was for sale for how much? I
mean, well, the 2K version that Emery's referring to was $5,000.
Yep.
So you're getting that for free. Now, the question is, would you use it? Well, in the demo that Apple did, and I take nothing away from this thing because I think it's really, really cool. I don't know if anyone noticed, but they're like going through, and here we're doing the thing, and then we're doing the thing, and then when you do that, then it would all render. Now, here's one I've done before. And so we just skipped the entire render process, and I think quite a few people walked away thinking that that was real time. Now, I don't know how long it'll take to render because I just never saw. But the Assimilate Scratch stuff is certainly doing 2K in real time, non-destructively. So you can put on a 2K and you just say, I want to see that with the grade. Click one button, it's off. Switch one button, it's back on again because it's actually doing it on the fly.
And there was real-time performance in Final Touch if you had the Quadro FX 4500 card. I mean, most of the real-time performance should have translated into the new Apple product color. But I think it's, you know, like you said, it's you can do your first light pass, your primaries, but not, you know, when you start getting into your secondaries and certainly if you
masking.
Start building, yeah, masking and things like that, then it's no longer real-time.
But render's a problem that's easy to throw processors at if you want, well, if you need
yeah,
it that
absolutely.
Bad.
I just honestly don't know.
I know, we don't know. I saw a demo today. I watched it on the booth because I didn't get to go to the Apple thing. Because I was here typing. But I sat through a demo on the floor. And of course, obviously, like you say, it's a demo, but you know, it looked very. But it looked like a color session.
Did anybody else see the three-dimensional Kia in the color demo and go, "Isn't that the thing that looks remarkably like what we're used to in the modular Kia in Flame?"
Who called this the NAB for lawyers? Somebody referred to it.
Yeah,
as that. There's a lot
very
of
NAB for lawyers.
There's a lot of.
I have
things on the floor that I go, "Wow, that looks so." I mean, the number of people that are doing. Pattern recognition tracking, shape tracking. Everybody on the floor has something like that now. That's just one example. And I'm thinking, wait, there's got to be – I hope everybody's got this all sorted out.
Well, speaking of Motion 3, though, there's some pretty cool features in Motion 3. You have you know, 3D space, which is not real, true 3D space where you can import objects and 3D models, but it's, you know, 2.5D like you have in After Effects and things like that. But it also acquired from Shake, the optical flow engine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know what? Why don't we do a whole quick rundown of what's in the Final Cut package right after this word from our sponsors.
This FX podcast is made possible in part by GenArts, creators of the Sapphire plugins, the essential VFX toolkit for digital artists. Swing by booth SL2829 for demo of Sapphire on Autodesk Systems, Avid, and After Effects, or visit www.genarts.com for more information. Podcast is also made possible in part by SohoNet, the largest high-bandwidth connector for the global entertainment industry, delivering secure, high-speed connectivity to major media companies across Europe, the U.S., and Australasia. SohoNet also provides complete technology consulting on all digital workflow issues. And this podcast is also made possible in part by the support of DaVinci. Learn what the top post-production facilities around the world already know. DaVinci Systems offers the industry's finest image enhancement products. Visit DaVinci at www.davsys.com.
Thanks for that that sponsor thing. We actually have a lot of resources here at NAB thanks to those sponsors. So it's unusual for us to have ads, but we got to say thanks to those guys because they genuinely, you know, have really made a lot of the stuff we're doing here at NAB possible.
It looks like a music store blew up in here. We'll have to post some pictures of the suite. There's like microphones, mic stands, mixers. It takes a lot to do these things.
But just before we went to that break, Emery, you were mentioning about Motion, which is obviously one of the new aspects of the Final Cut. So let's run through that, will you? What's in Motion?
Well, in Motion, some of the cool things for me was, number one was the 3D space like we talked about. Also having the optical flow engine and tracking. Now you have tracking. You can do match moving, you know, four corner pinning and, you know, 1 and 2 point tracking, things like that in Motion, which is handy. I mean, I haven't used Motion a lot. It's like for my broadcast work, I mostly use After Effects. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you're used to one application and you just haven't fully switched over to the other. But, I think I'll definitely start using it more. So we also have some vector paint in Motion as well, and then the optical flow stuff. Which I think, Mike, you have some more information on the optical flow. There's two versions going on in Motion.
Well, actually, there were two versions in Shake of the optical flow algorithms that were being used. And one of those two versions was the version they pulled over to Motion. What's interesting about it, though, and I think I'm not aware of them having done this certainly in Shake, but what they've done in the implementation, as I understand it, like don't quote me, in Motion, is that they actually do an analysis of the clip to do the optical flow analysis. And if you understand how retiming through optical flow works, there's quite a laborious process as the computer literally tracks every pixel from frame to frame to frame. Now what they're doing here, which is really clever, is that that initial track is actually saved in a separate file to the side on your hard drive. Now, why is that significant? It simply means that if I do a retime and I show it to the client, let's say, John, you're the client, and I say, you know, do you like this? Now, on any other normal box, if you go, yeah, I'd like to see it a little bit faster, I adjust my parameters and hit redo, and it recalculates the new optical flow. But in fact, the first pass of the vectors is stored, and that is the hard bit. When you come and say, hey, can I just see that a bit differently, it'll actually be real time because it's just accessing this stored separate data. And that'll be shared and linked to the original clip file, which means...
That's really interesting because it's automatic and transparent to the user. I mean, there are programs where you can save your motion vectors and so forth, call them in. But it's like you're going through that manual step yourself. And it's the nice thing about that is that it happens transparently for you in the background.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, I think, because like the tracking, they made a big point of the fact that instead of getting into this whole thing about what's my subpixel division and whether or not I've got the right settings, it's just going to automatically do that. And it had one thing that I thought was killer, which I want to see everywhere else, which is, you know, I want to track this thing, and I use the motorbike. I want to track this thing, so I put my tracker over it, and then voila, it starts popping up all these suggested points for tracking that it's forward tracked and says it's holding. So you think, I don't want to track off the nose, and it goes da-da-ding. There are six suggestions of what I think you should track off.
You mean the snapping? It would snap to points that you...
It doesn't snap to point. It literally, you hold the cursor over to say, I want to track off this drink bottle, and where you normally would look at the clip many times and say, you know what, the C of the word Corona, because I have a Corona here, by the way, the C of the word Corona is going to hold pretty well as I pop the cork and lift up the bottle. And I would judge that just from experience. What it's going to do is, as I bring it over the bottle of Corona, it's going to say, you know what, I suggest tracking off the C, the E, don't track off the N, and track off the bottom part of the logo.
It in fact does snap to when you're dragging over it, it in fact was snapping to those points that they think would be points you probably want to track.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood what you meant, snap to. Yeah. But there's like multiple options, right?
Right.
That's great.
So that's pretty cool. And the 3D stuff.
Well, the 3D stuff, it also applies to the particles. So now you have a 3D particle system. The same particles, but now they work in 3D. And I thought the vector paint was nice as well. Also working in 3D.
But is there an After Effects plugin that just suddenly seemed to be quite not so...
This is like actually, Emery and I were talking this. It's like all of a sudden, it seems like all the best parts of Trap Code, like Particular and 3D Stroke, and like all of a sudden, you know, and actually even like when you look at like the way that they preview the particle systems, you can kind of drag your cursor around and it shows you the particle systems in motion, which, man, I could have sworn I saw that in Particular.
Well, let's be fair though. I mean, like Particle Illusion started it, right? I mean, that's who they were one of the first guys with one of these particle systems.
Yeah, because it's an interesting problem, isn't it? Because motion has a lot of templates and some people never deviate from those templates, right? So I think one of the things they've been clever with in all the parts of the program is just providing lots and lots of good example files to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too as well. That's a great point. And for me, from a motion graphics design standpoint, it's a 3D thing that is really critical.
I mean, some of those templates, I mean, at first blush are really fantastic. But I think you're going to see there's going to be some stock moves that are going to creep up in, I think, you know, in a lot of less creative like sort of solutions. And I think they'll get played out pretty quickly. But for right now, it's, you know, I think it definitely, if you use it as a starting point for a larger creative process where you can manipulate the templates and, you know, keep on customizing and just using it as a generator for ideas, I think it's just a fantastic starting point.
You can also export those templates to Final Cut now, I think. Those templates will work in Final Cut.
Wasn't there a statement that motion actually is fully in Final Cut, that you can actually open them up in Final Cut?
Yeah, like you can, which gets us to the timeline, but I'm going to go ballistic when we get to the timeline, but so you can have a motion file, which you make a template up, as you just said, Emery, and then you can bring it, Jeff, into my timeline, and so I've got it now applied. Now I can then retype the text that I might be using. I don't have to go back to motion to do that, and I can change something on all the instances that's used. So if I've got a documentary and they decide to change all of the wipe designs, then all of the wipe designs would suddenly change if I wanted them to, rather than just have to go through individually one by one.
Which is sort of like the product from Digital Heaven that was they made for motion, which was the ability to create a template. And then you could feed it. What is it, Scott? You feed it like an XML file, and you could replace like you can make like 30 lower thirds. You make one template. Sounds like that supports sort of in Final Cut now.
The one thing along those lines when you create your project in motion and bring it into Final Cut, I didn't understand this before. Is that you can create drop zones effectively in motion, and then when you bring it into Final Cut, if I have this right, it's like you can, you know, take your video assets and drop them into these drop zones in this project you've transferred over. So, for example, if you have a placeholder for video to come, you bring the motion project in, find your source video in Final Cut, drop it into the drop zone, you're off to the races.
I'm really interested to see also as well, and you talked about After Effects, and one of the things I ran into in using Motion, big fan, I wanted to use it on jobs, that I just kept hitting these brick walls.
So that's what I was
just
going to
ask. Where
I
couldn't take it to the next level. I didn't have the kind of fine-tuned control that you have in After Effects. I'm really curious how much of that changed in this version as well, because I'd really love to use it.
Where do you think this is positioned? Because I never really figured out the position.
You know,
for
I think
motion.
It's the graphics engine of Final Cut. I mean, you've got tracking now, you've got paint. These are two huge things that were missing before.
Absolutely, that's true.
Of course, the live action stuff is already there with the Final Cut and the template stuff. I mean, it's motion graphics for a broadcast environment.
Right, so they're not going to. Okay.
And the tracking thing's probably effective to bring it in.
And optical flow.
Yeah.
And particles. And cute things. And can we talk about the timeline now? Please.
All right.
So didn't anybody else just get like completely just, you know, warm in good places over the fact that they've got a mixed resolution timeline?
Multi-codec
so, timeline. Oh my God, it's such a godsend.
That was the one of the things during the blogging when it came across, I was like, wow.
Not only mixed resolutions, but, you know, mixed formats. You can do PAL, NTSC, mixed frame rates. Yeah. I mean, everything.
And progressive interlace. Oh my God. This was just like drop and play, wasn't it? I mean, it was just stunning.
No rendering. Yeah.
And the first clip that you drag to a timeline, the timeline will automatically, you know, conform to whatever that clip is. So you don't have to like, you know, constantly go up to the easy setup and change the easy setup and then create a new sequence and then drag the clip into the, you know, so.
I mean, how many times have you set up something in Final Cut, thought you got it, okay, drag your first clip in, it goes red.
Red yep. bar.
It's
red
not
bar.
Native You're to like, this. And you go, yeah. Every time. So then you go like, what is it about this that I didn't set quite right? And so you look through it and then finally you find some little thing that you set to the wrong, the audio, the wrong sampling rate or something. Mm-hmm. And until you do that, it won't play in real time, where this one was great.
You know, and I can't say that I have, you know, I've run into situations in QuickTime where, you know, QuickTime can sometimes just kind of really screw up a clip with the metadata that's in it and everything. And no matter, you know, you'll look at the clip settings, you'll think you have the timeline, that, you know, set the right way, but you still have this goddamn red, you know, red line. Like, what the hell am I doing wrong? Hopefully this will solve, you know, one of those problems, but it's kind of more of a QuickTime architecture problem with the metadata, which is really screwy.
I have to say, I really hope they improve that, because one thing that is continually frustrating is you get a new QuickTime update, and I'm not sure if it's because the development teams are in different areas or something, but it breaks something in Final Cut.
This just happened recently in the latest update.
Yeah. I think to be a professional app and high-end, I can't afford to have – I mean, what we've ended up doing is you just lock your system and you never change your update.
Yeah, we're like stunt work. We're like, we can't afford to update this QuickTime on the off chance that Compressor, for example, would just bugger up.
Well, and generally you trust Apple updates. I mean, I'm pretty trusting. Oh, yeah. I usually do a clone first, but I usually accept them all. Well, QuickTime, you always have to think.
I do. I constantly – wait, because like inevitably you always hear about, you know, these conflicts.
Well, you know, the inside word from some of the Apple developers is that internally the Apple developers hate QuickTime. They hate QuickTime. I mean, it's a really old architecture, and there's not a really good API for it. And I mean, internally, like, you know, I know some of the people on some of the pro application teams that they just really hate working with it.
And in fairness, though, you know, working on the Flame or working on some other box, I'm not updating the system software every time it comes out. You know, if you're in a production system, you have it stable and you have it set up, it's not like you're updating QuickTime on it to get your iTunes to be able to have the new features. So in fairness, I mean, that is one thing from a production system.
But, you know, in fairness, also the other way, right, as they said at that user group, there are now 800,000 FCP users. So you'd think that if you're updating QuickTime, which, by the way, is what they're built on, that you would test it. And, you know, I mean, hey, I love QuickTime generally, but that is a big bugbear. But, hey, I mentioned Compressor a moment ago. Was anybody else, like, enthusiastic about the Compressor?
Tell us more about it, because I look much better.
I mean, well, it's more intuitive. I mean, I think the presets are a welcome addition. I mean, the range of the presets is a welcome addition. It's becoming much more intuitive. Well, it looks like it's much more intuitive. I can't say I have a ton of hands-on time, but, you know, I think that Compressor, I mean, a lot of people just shy away from it because it's like, you know, it's like one of these hanger-on applications. It's not one of these things that are completely obvious to use. But, you know, for people that have used it in production or used it to create, you know, DVDs or, you know, just other things, it is a fantastic tool. And to see it updated like this is a real welcome.
Yeah, we're putting out hours of material each week on our FXPhD website, and we really couldn't do it to the level of consistency that we're doing without using Compressor, because we can distribute the Compressor setups among multiple people. We have Apple scripts that are you drop the original movie on it. It does the Compressor presets, uploads the FTP sites and everything. So it really is useful piece of equipment and workflow, but it's great that it's getting a facelift and UI you know, a usability enhancement.
Well, I've actually been using Episode Pro because I've run into so many damn problems with Compressor. I mean, it's really screwed up a lot of, I mean, you know, doing you know, batch conversions for offlines and things like, I mean, I've run into some of the screwiest problems with, it's like, it's changed, you know, metadata in the QuickTime files, and it's, you know, it's not being read correctly by, you know, like in Shake versus Final Cut, it's being read differently, and it's, I've all sorts of problems. So I've been using Episode Pro. But there's also some integration with Episode Pro. I wasn't totally clear on that. Did one of you guys get information on I think like some of the compression settings you can set in Episode Pro will also work in Compressor? There's some sort of integration between the two of them.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I must admit, I just as John said, putting out 8 hours a week of content on FXPHD in HD, effectively, it's we just need a heck of a lot of stuff to work well. And so I guess for us, it's worth investing the time to work out. I mean, in your case, Emery, it's maybe slightly different, but in our case, we've got a very solid workflow of repeatability because it is, you know, 8 hours a week kind of thing. And so we can set up those pipelines and then use them. And so, of course, anything that enhances that is a good thing. And I think for certainly a lot of clients these days, have you remember the days that clients wouldn't even look at things, you know, like you do a test and, but now it's just like, send me a QuickTime, right?
Yeah. Well, but now it's getting more complicated because now it's like, oh, we need a Windows version and a QuickTime, a Windows Media version, we need a QuickTime version because this person has a laptop that won't play this and this person, you know, and then you get dealing with gamma issues and, you know, a smart engineer friend of ours told me that, you know, the deal is, you set up your workflow in your facility and you lock it down and everybody follows the same procedures. Otherwise, you have problems with this all the time. I mean, it really needs a rethinking in terms of stability, repeatability, you know.
And I guess the other thing is that on a sort of similar note to Compressor, the fact of the matter is that I haven't really used Soundtrack that much. Like I haven't used it. I've used it to a certain extent, like, but I haven't used it a lot. But there seem to be a lot of new enhancements to Soundtrack. I mean, John, you obviously use Soundtrack heaps because you set up the pipeline with our FXPHD workflow, but what did you think of the stuff with Soundtrack? I mean, Soundtrack...
That was amazing.
Yeah, and somebody said to me earlier today, and I don't know, someone I ran into, I think they were slightly drunk, but they were claiming that some of that's the 5.1 stuff had happened in the Vegas product before. Anyone else heard that?
I have heard that.
Yeah, and so apparently, I mean, I thought it was new, but apparently the that little graph of the 5.1 surround sound that they now got in Soundtrack. But, you know, one thing that I don't know if Vegas had or not, but certainly Final Cut has, is like 100 surround sound environments that are copyright-free that you can use. Did anyone pick up on that? Like airports and like forests, just as ambient 5.1 surround stuff, right? Which, you know, just being shipped with it, which makes me think... I'm going to need to clean off my hard drive on my laptop before I install this.
Well, when you install Soundtrack, the old version, it was like, I don't want to do this on my laptop. My drive is now full.
And Motion also comes with like, you know, tons of new content. So I'm sure that the install is going to be a beast on like 12 DVDs and take 5 hours to install.
Yeah, they really need to think about a special custom install that only installs all that stuff on a separate hard drive for you. A little FireWire drive. Nice. Wouldn't that be awesome? Because trying to find
assets
it all and move it, would never work.
Drive button.
What a concept. You can install the assets on a separate drive. I mean, you can do that. You can put them on a separate drive. Then you just, I mean, depending on, I mean, you might have to go into the application and point to where the content is for it to come up in the application.
It should be easy. It should be an easy thing because there's no, you know, a lot of people using these things on laptops and aren't going to.
Yeah. Speaking of assets, one of the things actually, both Emery and I went out of our ways to catch today was Final Cut Server. And I have to tell you, I mean, you know, this is such a new addition that even the people that were demoing the Final Cut Server had, you know, remarked that there's still some things that are being developed. But I think that, you know, we can talk about the details of it, and maybe it's not that interesting to the broader audience, but I think
it's interesting to us.
Yeah, well, but I think, but what I think is, I mean, there's certainly the things that you were hoping for, and I think the bigger picture about all these aspects of Final Cut Studio. And really, I think where Apple is going, and we talk all the things that are fascinating us, and then you factor in Red, and you factor in all these, you know, the things, the price point for creating a professional environment. I mean, if you were having an evergreen, brand new studio, there is just absolutely no way. Well, I'm speaking personally, there is no way I would put money into, and it's not that I don't respect Avid and I don't respect Unity. I do, and I they work well in great environments. But if you were starting a new facility, why would you not have a Final Cut based system
That's exactly right, because I know of a facility, and what you talk about with the server for Final Cut, the reason that they didn't replace their Avid was the lack of that.
Yeah.
And I think it shows that commitment
to hang on to.
Yeah, it does show kind of a commitment to the professional market that is really, I think, reassuring to those of us who like them.
But what's so amazing, in just in global view of the whole show with this, with Final Cut in particular, you know, $5,000 HD cameras, you know, below red, but at least, you know. So, I mean, you can now, the sound, the color, I mean, the tools that are in the hands of someone trying to make a film are just unbelievable.
You know, I think someone should set up some training so people can know how to use all this.
You know, it seems like a lot more people are going to need training, yes.
Yes, that was one of the jokes we made in the early days, is if you're having a gold rush, sell shovels.
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of a $5,000 HD camera, it's like we're talking about the Red, and I don't know if we want to talk more about it, but... But there's also some news that that Red is going to be developing, I don't know, what like a handy cam, like a smaller version of the Red.
It is absolutely true. It's been out on some sites today, and we got it firsthand from Ted, who is the leader of the rebellion at Red, in other words, the guy who's kind of running it. And he said, absolutely, there are three significant things that weren't actually in the official press releases, that weren't in the documentation that they're doing. And they won't give many details, so I know you guys are going to ask, but they don't say much, but they are. A professional pocket camera, which he would only say was not plastic, was professional, and wasn't a stills one. Okay, so it is effectively a film camera in your pocket, pocket size, but we know nothing else. We don't know anything else about it, when it's going to ship, anything else about it, but it's absolutely coming. And he made the big, big point, like twice, this is not pro-consumer. This is not, you know, semi... professional. This is 100% a professional camera. But other than that, he wouldn't go any further.
Wow.
The second of those is that they're going to get into 4K monitors or 4K screens. So they're going to actually make 4K displays. So you'll be able to buy from Red a 4K camera and then walk home and plug it into your 4K screen and have a look at it.
What technology?
I have no idea.
Okay.
And then not only that, but also a 4K projector.
And exactly right. The last one is the 4K projector. Did you get any info on the 4K projector?
I got no information on the 4K projector other than they're working on it. You know, but it seems like the they started developing these things because they're really frustrated with. I mean, again, it's the same way that the Red camera started. Was, you know, Jim's been a camera nut his entire life, and he was just extremely frustrated with what was out there. And when they started building the camera and they needed to project it in 4K. They had, you know, one solution, which was from Sony, and it was really expensive. They had, you know, the Sony projector has some problems, actually. I mean, I've been to some Sony 4K events where they have issues with the projector. They get, you know, like weird artifacts and things like that.
What do they feed into that? Like, what's it getting? I mean, what's the playback thing that plugs into the projector? Do you know?
It's a,
Q.
I don't want to say because I'm not 100% sure. I believe that there's actually, you connect it, it has multiple sources. You can do like dual link HDSDI, and you know what? I don't know. I'm not going to say because I don't know.
But, yeah, I don't know.
But anyway, so it seems like
we'll find out.
We'll find out
next podcast.
Next podcast. There we go. Homework.
So, but it seems like that the development of the 4K projector, you know, it happened from that same sort of process where they were extremely frustrated with the Sony 4K projector, and they're like, you know what? Screw it. Let's make our own. Let's do it how it should be done.
You got to love the fact they're not a publicly traded company and they can talk about stuff like this, you know? It's like so many, you don't have any idea what's going on.
What was that Enron-y rule that came in that stopped everyone talking?
There's a whole disclaimer page at the users group the other night, you know, every year about this stuff is all, you know, tech demo.
But wasn't there some law that people refer to? They talk about something act that somebody brought in that means that when you're talking to Autodesk, John, they can't say anything.
Sarbanes-Oxley, maybe?
There you go. That's it. Go.
Yeah. Autodesk, Apple,
everybody,
Adobe.
Everybody.
You know, they're all these public companies. Yeah.
So that's
and that's what's refreshing.
Yeah, company thing,
with,
right?
Yeah, yeah with, okay. with having a company like Red that's not a publicly traded company that can talk about these things.
I would argue Red's been built on that.
Yeah.
This is a rumor. This company started with the rumors before NAB last year. Huge internet buzz, huge, you know, and it's kept that going.
As cool as that handheld Red is, does anyone else have mixed emotions about that? I mean, I feel very strongly. I would love to have that, but I mean, as a very early initial purchaser of a very, you know, it's not an inconsiderable amount.
Are you saying now that that if somebody just bought a, I don't know, large Sony HD camera or something, and they're feeling uncomfortable because red's coming out, that you as a red owner is now feeling uncomfortable by being redded by red?
I might. Because wow. I am fully enamored of the red camera, and I've really, you know, put my money where my mouth is and spent a lot of time talking about it and thinking about it. But I have to say, if something came out, and as you're pointing out, I'm like, it's not a prosumer version of this camera. It's a professional version of the camera. Unless it's like some way it has some inferiorities to the red. It's like, I'll be a little bummed.
Say, do we think that red is going to artificially cobble its own camera to stay in line with industry expectations?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, obviously they're not giving any details, but they didn't say we're developing a red 2 camera. They're developing a pocket, small, you know, red camera. So it's got to be inferior to the red 1 camera.
Well,
I would imagine, you know, maybe
define
it's 2K.
Inferiority.
Well, you know,
I mean, is it the fact that it's 2K?
Maybe it's 2K. Maybe it doesn't have interchangeable lenses. You can still have a very professional camera without it being 4K. I mean, let's not forget, like, 2K was an extremely professional camera. Not too long ago, and still is today.
Yeah.
and it still is today. So, and maybe it doesn't have interchangeable lenses. Maybe it's not PL mount. You know, who knows? I don't think they're going to make a camera that's going to trump the Red One camera and have it be half the size.
You can't make something that goes in your pocket that has interchangeable cine lenses. I mean, you just can't, right?
Yeah.
Well, if they truly mean like in your pocket, I guess, you know, that's different.
But
I don't mean to take away from it, because I think it could be a great companion. You know, it was like just even like a witness camera for, you know, the larger Red One. But
well, there are a whole lot of lenses that aren't the BL mount of the cine lenses that are taken by the Red camera, and a lot of people own those, and they're a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So it could have interchangeable lenses, but ENG lenses.
Well, the other thing is that, I mean, you know, so a Red camera package, you're going to spend, you know, maybe $25K, now lenses aside, but if you want to like fully pimp out a Red camera, you can pretty much do it for about $25,000. If you're going to purchase a camera for $25,000, you should be able to make that investment back in 1 year. I mean, if you can't, you shouldn't be buying the camera. And I don't think that we're going to see a pocket-sized camera for at least a year.
Wow. I was just thinking the 25 sounded low to me.
Yeah, I think it's 25. You're pimping it out. I reckon you.
Well, come on. I mean, so I'm also now, I should note, I'm also including, I'm, you know, being a reservation holder, I'm getting a $2,500 credit,
right,
you know, which all the reservation holders are getting. So, you know, $2,750. I'm not talking about a tripod and all that. I'm talking about the accessories that Red is selling without the lenses. Without the lenses. You can put a fully pimped out package together for about $2,750.
Well, you have to define pimped out. I mean, the memory options. I mean, if you're
That's not including the $4,500 Red RAM option. That's with the 320 gig Red drives, and that's with
like
a compact flash.
The Suburban option as opposed to the pimp option, I would totally agree. But I think if you pimped a Red camera, I would reckon you get no change out of 40. But having said that, I think
with the accessories that they're offering,
you pimp it out, you're going to want to put that $19,500.
I think that for 99% of the people that are going to be using the camera, you don't need the fiber port on it, which is pretty expensive. So I'm not including that.
Got me on the definition of pimping here, because I thought pimped out meant...
All right, fine. So
because I'm not an American, right? I probably don't understand the expression.
It's the same in America, but I think you can put together a very, very fully featured, okay, maybe not pimped, but fully featured...
I just registered the domain pimpmyred.com. Yeah.
Keeping your red hand strong.
But I was saying your point is valid, right? I think your point's totally valid. And I wouldn't normally say a year. I would say 100 rental days. Like on a camera like this, it's 100 days to pay back your rental. You work out what you're going to pay for that camera, divide it by 100, and that is the absolute lowest point you should go for the rental price.
Right. I mean, in rental aside, if you're going to be doing your own productions with this, I mean, then that's a totally different business model. So
yeah, no, I think my point is that in, you know, you're quoting statistics about what 99% of the people are going to be using this camera for. I mean, you could try to figure out the statistic of how many people are going to actually be doing something in 4K. So if you're saying that a dialed back version of the Red One, this handheld camera, just does 2K, I think a lot of people are going to be operating in that space, let alone the fact that, I mean, there's a lot of solutions out there that can even, you know, you start picking up some pieces for the cost differential of like going to like, help me out, Blackmagic, you know, some things that allow you to do real-time 2K playback. I mean, that is not a minor camera. That's a, for a lot of people, that could be...
I just want to point out that when I was pricing the tripods today for my semi-pimped, semi-whore, semi-gorgeous, angelic virgin camera, that the tripods that Jimmy was like, hey, we should get this one, it was like $5,000. Like, the friggin' camera doesn't go, what, $5,000 on the tripod? He's like, well, you want a fluid head, and you want to be robust and stuff. So apart from the camera, right, like you're going to be committing a lot to the kit, and that's, as mm-hmm. you said, before the lenses.
But that kind of stuff is, I mean, all that supporting equipment you can use with, you know, all sorts of different cameras. So it's not, I don't include that in a red.
But I guess my point
package is
that if you get a pocket camera that's a much smaller, much lighter camera,
yeah,
then that's going to fall into a whole lighter weight tripod, lighter weight. It's probably going to be, you know, if it isn't fixed, it probably isn't fixed lenses, but they're going to be definitely cheaper lenses, smaller lenses, or just stills lenses, which could be a thing.
Well, and also when you consider, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the RedUser.net, you know, board, but if you really listen closely to the way a lot of the people are talking, it's not an inconsiderable number of people that are on that forum. They're still like wrapping their heads around how, even if they are reservation holders or they're thinking about getting the camera, they're wrapping their heads around what does it mean to invest in this camera. And a lot of those people are taking a huge leap from being sort of the prosumer level going to. I don't even think a lot of people fully appreciate how professional this is. This is a serious camera. It is,
and you're certainly not going to be getting the $5,000 a day in Australian. This is how much a Genesis goes for, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Because they're going to be, let's face it, a lot of cameras on the rental market by the end of the year.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, if you don't buy one, you could definitely rent one by the end. And you want to rent one for Christmas? I'm thinking you're going to get a deal.
And how about how screwed are all the other camera manufacturers right now? I mean, but you know what? It's funny. It's like I don't think that they even know how screwed they are. It's like you go around and they – I mean, are they? Do they just not know what's going on? Do they not, you know, go to the Red Booth? Do they not, you know, read, you know, articles and forums online? Because, you know, they're offering stuff that's the, you know, it's the same old. I mean, I think they're banking on the fact that, you know, they have customers that have used them for a long time. They, you know, they're customers that have used their workflow for a long time, and those relationships, they hold really strong. It's like if you're in a network environment or studio environment, it's like those customers are going to continue doing business with you. The business model works for them, you know, paying those prices, and they'll continue to do so for a couple of years. But I mean, there's an interesting
parallel between Avid and Final Cut. I mean, you have people that are fully invested in architecture. And maybe they want to change, but they can't change. I mean, your infrastructure is so predominantly based on.
No, I was just going to say, you know, the market that we live in nowadays, how many times have you had a shoot where they say, I'm sorry about the green screen, we didn't want to pay for the bigger lighting package? It's like, wait a minute. If we're cheaping out on lighting packages, don't you think when a cheaper camera rental option is going to come around, that's going to become a factor if the camera's good enough?
I also think the broadcast market has a big difference with that. ENG, mm-hmm. other things like that. They're not going to be diving in the red thing because of the workflow initially, of course.
Yeah, but
and that's one thing that Panasonic is doing. I think that does bear a little the difference, but I do think they're naive. I think that they're just blind to it. I don't think, especially with some of the recent announcements.
If I'm the engineer on that new Dulce camera that does 4K but only at 30 frames a second and is like $100,000, I'm not buying a new car this week.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, even the really high-end cine cameras, I mean, it's like there's nothing out there at NAB that comes even like remotely close, like not even slight competition for Red, not even a tiny little bit, except for those people that I mentioned, the people that are invested in those infrastructures and invested in, you know, whatever, just they've worked with them for years. If you're a knowledgeable person, I can't imagine that you would choose any one of those cameras over the Red camera, you know.
Yeah, and there's actually, you know, and Mike, you had some really cool insights on one of these things I'm about to mention, but there was a couple I thought were interesting little surprises, and they were just announced today. There's, John, back to your points, I mean, talk about the ENG crowd, and you talk about the broadcast crowd. There was two things. There was an announcement of a Red Super Grip, you know, clearly intended for a studio environment.
That's true. Yep.
And there's also something called the Red Motor, which I think is, on one hand, it's targeted to the ENG crowd, and... But Mike, you had a really good point about its other alternative use.
Well, I mean, you know, Red is good at trying to do stuff themselves, but also they're not oblivious to working in the industry. And so they actually got that set up with a system so you can have like multiple controls hanging off the one camera. So you could have, for example, three motorized things happening. Now, that might be because you've got one on focus and one on, Zoom or whatever, but... It's also possible, if, for example, you could have them synced up because you've got two cameras side by side for some kind of stereoscopic thing, and you've got, you know, one on one camera, one on another. So there's a lot of stuff in there, I reckon, for just like a professional market that understands that there's professional things out there and those sort of motion control aspects are what we're going to need. It's the bits and bobs, you know, that's what really makes professional. Mm. Like you have to be able to nail it right down to the last bit.
And by the way, and speaking of just, you know, professional quality of the camera, it's like we finally got to see in person, you know, the quality of the manufacturing of the accessories, you know, the LCD, the viewfinder. And I mean, by the way, I was shocked at how large the viewfinder is. I mean, the thing is like a tank. It is a, it's a beast. I mean, it's very sexy, but it's a beastly.
It's like a bottle of water size.
Yeah, it's really big. And we didn't get to see, they didn't have a working version of the Focus Assist tool, which was, you know, it's been talked about on the boards quite a bit. They weren't showing anything working for that, which I want to see it actually working. I was interested in seeing that, but it didn't show up.
Hey, before we get too carried away with just talking about the Red camera, Jeff, you managed to get around and talk to a few other people, and I think we should cover a couple of those today. And do you have any other sound bites you got from people down on the floor?
Well, John and I were looking at the Mokey people, the Imagineer people.
Yeah, we're kind of focused on Roto with the new Roto class we've got going at FX PhD this term.
Definitely
going
to be one of our most popular courses, I think, on PhD.
Yes, we went down to see them because they have a new product called Motor. And we talked to Ross Shane from Imagineer about
it. We're showing a brand new product called Motor, which is a standalone Roto tool. Just to back up one second, all of Imagineer's products, all of them, across the board, use a really unique tracking technology called planar tracking, which works quite different than a pixel-based tracker. But it really helps compositors with very tricky shots, as well as deal with things that typical point trackers might have problems with, such as motion blur and grain and things like that. So anyways, what Motor is, it's a standalone, basically rotoscoping tool that runs on Mac, Windows, or Linux. And it uses the planar technology to track the roto splines. Again, planar technology is a really unique technology where you're defining planes in an image as opposed to the actual pixels. The way the technology works is it goes to the next frame and it basically tries to find all the transformation, scale, even perspective between the two frames. And again, it really helps you deal with things that might sort of break even very powerful pixel-based trackers. Motor is basically used for compositors, and it's a great way to kind of allow compositors to take their work on everyone has rotoscoping, obviously, whether it's in the broadcast industry or in film, right? So what Motor is this standalone roto tool where you can roto on your system, even if it's a laptop for that matter, and you can send your shapes to discrete systems. The actual shape data turns into roto splines to combustion or to shake. Beyond that, you can render mats, which obviously are good to go in any compositing system. All of Imagineer's software is also available as node locked, right, or floating. And even floating across platforms. Okay, so you could a facility could buy a seat of a software and run it with a license server, just similar to certain other softwares, 3D softwares or Shake for that matter. Across, you know, run it one day on Linux, and other artists could open up the next day on a Mac platform, etc. You know, we've had really excellent feedback. You know, over the years, Mokey's been around for quite a while, as well as Monet as our placement station. And probably the biggest feedback is we love this technology, but we kind of, you know, we want a more affordable solution. So I think that's, you know, the biggest impetus for creating Motor, as well as kind of discuss everyone needs to rotoscope. Do you really want to do it on your expensive gear? It's kind of bringing this tool to, you know, people who specialize in it, in rotoscoping, as well as... I think it's also interesting because, you know, even in the After Effects market, there's not really any tools there as standalone rotoscoping. So it's kind of, I think we're at a nice place with this product. The only thing I would just add is there's always a little sort of confusion about what product is which, because you do have Monet, Mokey, and Motor now. So just to kind of, in a nutshell, I think this might be interesting to compositors out there, which is sort of think of this like Monet is the placement station. Kind of the typical example of a Monet job is a monitor replacement. Mokey is the removal station, wire removal, or doing things in typical compositing systems where you might have to clone and track and offset and all these. It automates a lot of these tasks. And now the new product, Motor, is the standalone rotoscoping product.
Yeah, I think it is. It's really an interesting product, and I think it's interesting that, you know, they have a lot of great technology there and their planar tracking that they have in Imagineer. It's interesting that they brought that into Roto. Because it really can, the way the software tracks and the way you do roto, it really makes localized tracking really effective, I think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously demos are demos, but what I saw, they definitely were, had talked to and been involved with a lot of roto and did things that made me go, okay, they understand this and the workflow and the tracking. It just seemed like a real time saver.
A lot of the guys I've talked to have really mentioned this product. I've seen the stuff on the web about it, seen the movies on the web about it. A lot of the PhD postgrads have talked about it because they've seen it as well. And it's really interesting. And I just want to mention also they've got an amazing show special right now. And the product's normally about $15.95, and right now they're $600 off. So for under $1,000, you can get a copy of Motor.
If you have to be here at the show for that, or?
It is, but we actually talked to them. And what we'll be doing is we're going to be posting an order form on the FX Guide site. And if you fill out this form and fax it to the number that we provide in London, they're going to honor the show special for anyone who comes by the site. So you can actually pick up this app for like under $1,000. And you know what? They never have any sales. You know,
guys are like renowned for like holding the price. So in other words, hang on, just make a check on this. So if I'm in Australia and I want this, I just
come to the FX Guide site. We'll have a link up there to the PDF page. Fill it out, fax it to London, and she promised that they'll respect it.
And that price is in dollars, right? Not in pounds.
U.S. dollars.
Okay.
And that link will be in the story for this podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. You know, the cool thing about Imagineer is that they really spend a lot of time focusing on working with, you know, real visual effects artists. They spend a lot of time working with post-production companies. So when they build their tools, they really have a lot of input from the people that are actually using it. And you can see it when you work with their products.
Remember, it was such a dearth of roto products. It seems like the new category has been born, and there's lots of people in this game.
Yeah, I mean, we've
thank God, right?
Yeah, totally.
I know.
But having said that, you know, we've got Silhouette in the FX PhD course, and that's something that people can use for free as part of the courses because it's on VPN. And I think that Silhouette's really, really good. And but what's increasingly becoming apparent is that roto is one of the big entry-level job things. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to become a senior compositor, you're not going to walk in and become a senior film compositor straight off the bat. And one of the great ways to get in these days is to work in the roto department. And I've got a lot of interest from people because they want to get in, they want to work on big teams, and they see that as a way for like an entry-level position. And you do a huge amount of features.
We have a large roto department at Hydraulics where I'm freelancing. And oh, by the way, I should give a shout-out to those guys. There's a lot of deadlines hitting right now, and I'm here at NAB.
Oh, by the way, Jeff, I got a drink.
Oh, thanks. What was I saying?
I don't know.
I do. I really appreciate it. It's a great group of people, and they're all working very hard back there. And I'm sitting in a suite instead of in a bar. But
big shout-out to MB, too. How are you?
There you go.
Hey, but you've got, like, God, I don't know, what, how many flames?
17, plus whatever's rental at the time. And
sure, plus it's Kick-Ass 3D department.
World's largest 36-node
burn farm.
Yeah, which is kicking it.
Large, but 3D department, large roto.
But no one's going to walk into you and say, hey, I want to work on X-Men 6 and be out of college or even from something like PhD. It's going to be something like they've done roto, right, to get into...
Oh, yeah. Somebody's signature on one of the forums says something like, if you don't like roto, get out of the business.
You know, it's funny. I'm getting out of the business, man.
You know, I don't know how many people like it after you've done it for a while, but at least... You know, it's part of life, and you figure out tricks. And some of these software, like the Motor that we saw and the Silhouette Roto, have tricks in them that, you know, really are helping things get better. And this pattern tracking stuff that seems to be the rage now, it's really, hopefully, makes life easier.
You know, it's funny, because I think I sort of, I bypassed having to sit in the trenches and do Roto forever. I mean, I you know what, to be honest, I'm not very good at Roto. I hate doing it, and I've never had to do it extensively. Of course, I have to do it from time to time, but I guess I'm lucky.
Well, you know, I think that's good reason for death threats, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Hands up all of those who spent many too many hours into the early morning trying to Roto the impossible. Because I know I'm in that category. But you know what? I mean, I still, with all these tools, at the end of the day, like, you get a film like Flags of Their Fathers. I mean, the guys that did the roto on that, they're just outstanding. And they probably don't get the credit they deserve because they just use no green screen. They're blowing shit up. They've got guys walking and stuff. No green screen at all.
Now, you know, I feel for these guys, and I want to check out the FX PhD class for Roto, because I look at some of the shots. I remember seeing some stuff from King Kong when they were like in the forest with like leaves blowing around. I'm like, how the hell
did you? Diaries, the Kong Diaries. They had an interview with those guys once, and I think one of the people said, you know, when I walk outside now and I've been working on this, I look at the lines on every bit of nature. I'm like, how can I rotoscope this out? It becomes part of your life.
Well, you know, that course is being hosted by Tal Naran, and he's actually one of our most popular professors at PhD. He's done a huge amount of Shake stuff, and he's a hell of a nice guy as well. But, yeah, I think that's probably going to be an oversubscribed course. It's, well, that's not, you can have an oversubscribed course. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's going to really
please subscribe all you'd like.
Hit a chord with people because, yeah, as I say, like, if you are trying to get into the industry, it's a good way. And I think that and 3D tracking is another entry. I don't know what else is the good way to get in these days. Because, you know, we used to have assistants.
No, the rotor department, you know, we have guys that pull off the miracles every day. I mean, and like you said, the flags of the fathers. I mean, and you know, frankly, there's a lot of people who are not, you know, on set. You make decisions to save time because it's very expensive. And we roto. And, you know, we worked on 300. There was a lot of roto in 300.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the people helping out.
A lot of people. A lot of big crowd scenes.
Sorry. Yeah, totally. No, I was going to say one of the people helping out, Tal, was on roto for a year at DD. One of the other professors that's going to be on that course. He was in feature film for like a year, John.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Like iRobot and stuff. Yeah. And yeah, it's hardcore stuff. And it's hard. Like that.
There's some crazy scenes that, yeah.
Oh, my God. That stuff with the leaves and stuff. And that just doesn't happen by accident. You're absolutely right. I saw that thing you were talking about.
Yeah.
And those guys are like unsung heroes, I reckon.
There, we should toast them.
They don't get generally
roto artists across the world.
So that we don't have to.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, is there anyone else before we finish up that you managed to hit on the booth? So tomorrow we're going to hit some great people down on the floor.
Yeah, we are going to hit some great people on the floor. One thing we want to mention today, of course, that we've talked about Apple a lot, but Adobe had a public beta come out of the new version of After Effects, Premiere, and their production suite, which is pretty interesting. So tomorrow night, Mark Christensen, who's a big After Effects guy and just got off working on Pirates as well, is going to be on the podcast with us.
He has some great books.
By the way,
For any app, it's an
Mark
After Effects book.
That his After Effects, the studio techniques, I think it was, or was there's just some phenomenal stuff in there. You're absolutely right. Across just a kind of random shout out, but that is a great book.
Oh yeah, Mark's brilliant. But it's very lucky that that beta came out because we were counting on that for his CS3 course for this coming term for PhD because he's doing another one. He's very successful last term. I'm losing my voice, sorry. And so if CS3 hadn't come out today in AE, I don't know what. We'd have just been rewriting madly. And I should also point out that now that Final Cut 2 is out, we should say that that is definitely happening in the Final Cut course because Doug's been sitting there going, if Final Cut 2 doesn't come out at NAB, you know, what am I going to be doing in the end part of it? Because coming out obviously in about a month, which was a month into the term. But yeah, he'll be doing a whole lot of cool stuff with that. And we've got some other good stuff. And Damien, we recorded a thing on turning normal footage into stereoscopic footage with him. And he'll
be joining Damien Allen, who
is the author of the textbook that's optionally available for PhD this term. And it's just so cool. He's this Duran Duran film clip. And I'm just sitting there thinking, because you're talking about roto, it's made me think of it, right? Because like, one of the huge things in that was the vast amount of roto to turn normal footage off a normal HD camera, or actually 10 HD cameras, into stereoscopic for the entire...
This is a huge thing. Hollywood's, I mean, all the animated features, Meet the Robinsons just came out in 3D. Mm-hmm. It wasn't animated in 3D. It was created in 3D afterward, from what I understand.
Really?
Yep. So, same kind of techniques, yeah.
Oh, wow, really?
As far as I know.
I assume that was like a press a button thing on CGI.
Yeah,
but
I understand it's being done on a lot of films right now.
Yeah, maybe in like some separate occasion we can talk about. But I'm firmly convinced that 3D is just a huge, important step for theaters regaining audiences and pulling them away from home theater setups.
Yep. I mean,
it's one of those experiences that, you know, it drives you. It's like even I just remember seeing Monster House and thinking, man, this is just a lot of fun to see like a simple, fun movie. But just like the novelty of 3D is back, and it's very engaging.
No, I think there's mixed feelings on that though. Like Superman, I saw Superman in 3D, and it's like some parts are cool.
Mike
and
has his 3D glasses.
Right. Elton John,
it's very cool, Mike.
John, this is Celine week, I think, isn't it?
These are my official 3D blue, and actually, I learned this today. Cyan and red 3D glasses.
Which is this like the point where we give an audio cue to the audience to put on their 3D glasses and the podcast becomes...
Oh, a 3D podcast. 3D. Very exciting.
The 3D podcast
becomes 5-1. I don't know what.
There we go. We have a picture now. Good.
It can get a little obnoxious, though, I think. I mean, for some stuff it works. Like, I think I liked the idea, like in Superman, where some scenes were in 3D. Like, I would not want to sit through the entire film that way. Certainly not. But it's added value. Where you can see like certain scenes in 3D.
Well, let's talk in a couple of years when Cameron's Avatar comes out and that's in 3D.
Yeah. You know, I worked on T2
in 4 hours of it.
Oh, you worked on two
T2 3D, the theme park ride.
I'll be back. Cameron was
Dr. Ken Jones was at CIS with me, and he was he worked at JPL in 3D imaging there, and he was our consultant and ended up running the project for us. We did shots for Digital Domain at CIS. And he was explaining to me things about, you know, how you can get it wrong so easily, and then you get a headache, and it's not just something casually to be done. I mean, it's a very
vomiting audiences would not be.
You know,
have
yeah.
you seen that? It was actually Terminator 2.5, effectively, wasn't it?
It was called T2 3D. It was
sat yep. between Terminator 2 and the latest.
Right, right. It was 6 70-millimeter projectors.
Wow.
In sync.
I'll tell you where 3D has a market. It's in porn.
On that new 4K screen.
Oh God, I think there's some things you actually don't want to see in 4K.
There's like, yes, absolutely. That's incredibly well said. Actually,
things can be a little too high definition.
You know, the adult industry is always ahead of the curve in terms of technology. So,
see, I think that's an urban myth. I have a theory that is urban myth, right? Because my theory is that once upon a time, somebody said that when the VHS versus Beta war happened. Right, but how can anyone know that? How can anyone know that the?
Well, I mean, the adult industry has been ahead of the curve for, you know, video online, and, you know, like they're pumping out Blu-ray. I mean,
I think they're ahead of the curve in spam. I'll give you that. But I think these aren't very bright people, right? Like, I mean, you know, really, this is not like, you know, what do I want to do when I grow up? I want to be a technology guy at a porn company. I mean, that's not going to happen.
No,
they just
have
to implement tools to the mainstream or implement different technologies to the mainstream a little quicker than the general industry. That's
absolutely
all.
Right.
Because our porn industry in Australia is stupid.
Online payment systems exist because of that. I mean,
yeah.
Really, so you're saying there's a market opportunity?
Well, no.
I just think that's full stop.
Do they need training? I wonder if we have any students that are in the porn industry. If you do, let us know.
What? You're insane.
This is the corrupting influence of being in Vegas.
Yes,
so
it is.
Next term for FXPhD coming soon.
Okay.
Emery Wells.
No, I have an unsubstantiated number that I'd heard that the porn industry financially makes more money than all motion pictures, television. I mean, it's like a huge monetary. I don't know the industries. It was a list of all the entertainment industries, and it was.
See, this is something like that urban myth that I've heard so many times that the gaming industry is as big as the film industry, right? And people like throw that around. And then if you actually look at the statistics, the gaming industry, including consoles, including hardware, which are, let's face it, like what is one of those new ones worth here? Like a lot, right? Like
PS3 is like $600.
Okay, so including those sales, they're equivalent to first run theater tickets for cinemas. Once you factor in DVD sales, take out the hardware from the gaming and add in any of the merchandising, all the other crap that goes in the film industry, and TV sales and everything else, it's like one-fifth of the revenue. But
well,
once
I think
it gets
out on
the internet...
It's fair to add the hardware, I think. But yeah, but you should definitely, if you're adding the hardware for the gaming industry, you should definitely add all the, you know all the other markets that for film. Like
then
the
you have
DVD
to add
sales
the
and
movies that were made of games. Just to complicate things.
What was that one?
Lara Croft and
there was that really atrocious one where the guy was like Duke Nukem type thing where it was just.
Oh, you're talking about Doom with the Rock.
Doom, yeah, and like the last part of the movie was just like wandering down.
Yeah.
With oh my god, who thought that was a good idea? But anyway, I think we've probably exhausted the topics for this week, haven't we? Tonight,
I think we're good.
Well, we promised less red coverage tomorrow.
Yeah, and less red porn.
Wow.
although we are talking to Red tomorrow. So.
Yeah, that's true.
We're talking to Ted.
All right, we'll talk to some Red tomorrow. But
hey, a really huge thanks to our guests tonight.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate you guys coming by.
Honestly, I was so psyched to be here. I'm just a huge fan of the FX Guide and the podcast.
And I got to say, I'm so excited about the ProjectRed.net site, too. I mean, I think this is going to be brilliant going forward.
Well, that's the coolest thing about online, right? It's like, you know, we met just by you know.
We met online.
We met online. Actually, it was on an online dating site.
Actually,
funny enough.
Actually, I met Jeff online as well.
Yeah,
me.
That was way before
MySpace, but it's great to finally meet. You know, like we've been talking online for a while, and, you know, it's just fun. It's great to finally, you know, get together and work on something collaboratively. So.
Yeah. And I think I should point out that this whole idea of this Red project was not something we hatched today over a couple of beers. In fact, we've been working on this for I don't know how long now, months, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that we're committed to, which is we like to believe we're always committed to here, is this is like an ongoing project that isn't just suddenly going to fall by the wayside, right? Like, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that's going to come up in the next few days, in the next weeks and months, but what we like to think is that this is something that if you invest time in, we'll invest time in, and together we'll move forward. And I think, you know, a year from now, we should get back together here and work out whether or not we kept to that. And I hope we can, because I really think there's a lot to be learned from it. Dead silence.
Well said.
It's like you just can't hear us nodding.
Yeah. No, guys. No, seriously. That's the sound of nodding. Thanks so much for having us here. I mean, you know, we both love the FX Guide and FX PhD stuff, so it's really cool to be on the podcast.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.
This special NABFX podcast is made possible in part by the support of DaVinci. Learn what the top post-production facilities around the world already know. DaVinci Systems offers the industry's finest image enhancement products. Visit DaVinci at www.davsys.com. By GenArts, creators of the Sapphire plugins, the essential VFX toolkit for digital artists. Swing by booth SL2829 for a demo of Sapphire on Autodesk Systems, Avid, and After Effects, or visit www.genarts.com for more information. This podcast is also made possible in part by SohoNet. SohoNet is the largest high-bandwidth connector for the global entertainment industry, delivering secure, high-speed connectivity to major media companies across Europe, the U.S., and Australasia. SohoNet also provides complete technology consulting on all digital workflow issues.